What band was she in?
Yeah, she
is. Plasmatics?
Mastodon.
Mastodon.
Yeah. Yeah, she was good. She was their second guitarist.
She was the lady who created, I know that people associate her with apes. I think, didn't she create Bonzi Buddy? Bonzi Buddy?
All right, then I retract my previous tribute to Jake Goodall. Fuck her.
Fucking couldn't get that thing off my computer. Had...
Welcome back to the Trilateral Troika. This is Steve, along with the other Steve.
I fucking love haichus. Pineapple haichus?
Solid choice. And Ryan.
I'll pour one out for the late, great Jane Goodall, who is a fucking gangster who said, I believe that
what band was she in?
Donald Trump should be shot into the sun. She was great.
What band was she in?
Yeah, she is.
The Plasmatics?
Mastodon.
Mastodon.
Yeah. Yeah, she was their, she was their second guitarist.
She was the lady who created, I know that people associate her with apes. I think, didn't she create Bonzi Buddy? Bonzi Buddy?
All right, then I retract my previous tribute to Jake Goodall. Fuck her.
Fucking couldn't get that thing off my computer. Had,
she had Amy the Gorilla coded, so...
Isn't she, like, who Michael Crichton was inspired to write Congo about? Like, not like her, but like her work with the gorillas and like the sign language and shit?
Well, she didn't work directly with Amy. She worked with chimps. I think she did interact with Amy, but Amy is the basis for the ape that's in the gorilla that's in Congo.
Ah, okay. Oh, and there's an actual gorilla. Okay.
But yeah, it's the gorilla that can speak with sign language. I think Coco's the real gorilla. Amy is the name of the gorilla in Congo.
I was going to say, because Amy sounds like... Yeah. All right, now Coco sounds right. Yes.
Coco the monkey.
She's an ape, Steve. She was an ape.
That's a fucking tortoise.
Not a monkey.
That's a turtle. That's a tortoise. It's a fucking turtle. I know literally everything there is to know about turtle.
It's just a turtle, man. It's got a shell. It's a turtle.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone want to hear any mantis facts?
Yes. Always down for a good praying mantis fact.
Tell your roommate to stop downloading the AK Wonder Woman rip so you stop, like, you know. You stop roboting on Discord. Like, hey, buddy, can you pause the AK Wonder Woman rip, like, with the with the Zionist
he's
subtitles?
He's watching a stream on Discord right now, so that might be it.
But. Oh, yeah. I could do it. That son of a bitch. He's son of a bitch.
It's a stream right, of boys, somebody in the movie theater with their phone reporting the recording.
Guys, I don't want to alarm you or anything, okay? I know you guys sometimes get upset because I'm always raising a fuss, but, you know, I just, when I did the Arnold accent there, I swallowed a haichu without chewing it. So that's going to be down there for at least 25 years, digesting slowly as it rolls.
Well, while
and
you're in the hospital.
Like fucking
while you're in the
waters.
Hospital. I'll get you the cam rip, you know, that my roommate's watching that's done by a guy with, like, a 1980s camcorder under, like, a trench coat.
Oh, God.
The one that, like, at the bottom, it's
that Seinfeld
got, like,
episode.
Subtitles. It says, like, 720p. It's got, and then like, all the website the... at the bottom.
He does
it just,
beautiful
It just has
work.
A bunch of, like, this has, like, Indian gambling site ads all over it.
You could hear people in the theater talking and shit. Dude, do you remember the Pirate Bay from back in the day and ripping movies like that?
You mean in Minecraft?
If you, like,
yeah.
Get a DVD from somebody, they're like, hey, listen, this is, like, you know, whatever, the latest, greatest new movie, and you put it in, it's like, dude, what the fuck is this? This is the worst rip of anything I've ever seen in my life.
All the bootlegs we would get in China were copies of actual, like, DVDs. Mm-hmm. Like, they were always, like the actual, like, release that somebody at the factory, like, just, like, burned a bunch of extras and, like, sold them on the side.
Mm,
you know,
nice.
Got their bonus. Brilliant.
I got a lot of kung fu movies back in the day that way. I won't go into it, though, here, because it's a public forum. Not that the Shaw Brothers are just going to come after me. You know, who are they going to send? Some decaying fucking Lolier? Yeah. Freaking Jet Li. That's... I could probably take Jet Li now. Jet Li's like 60.
I don't think you could, bro. I'm just going to say, that's like somebody that's... saying they could take Tyson because he's like in his 60s.
No, that's a lot different than saying you could take Tyson, okay? Jet Li's not an actual fighter. He's just a fucking martial artist. That's all he is. All right? This guy never fought.
This is the exact moment.
You have no evidence of him ever winning a real fight. He's a Taoist, first of all. So, as someone who was somewhat a Taoist, I was pretty hard into it for a while there. He's a pacifist, probably. I don't know. I'm going to assume Jet Li is pretty acrobatic, but I doubt that dude can take a hit.
That's when we hear the shattering of glass and a bunch of Chinese men wearing only like silk zubas are like in Steve's room squaring up to fight him.
Well, Jackie Chan actually could take a hit because Jackie Chan trained Beijing Opera and those guys got the shit beat out of them, man. Like, Jesus. It's like some of the worst shit.
Marge, the little guy hasn't done anything yet. I want to see what he's going to do.
Very similar. It's a very similar situation there. Anyway. Mike Tyson's definitely not the same. Mike Tyson's a trained killer, dude. Like, the idea, like, I really feel like we've reached the post-truth world, like, right now. We need a reformation because it all started with that Jake Paul fight. I mean,
that's where it started.
That was the dumbest shit ever, bro. Like, just watching the fight, you could see him pulling punches. It was like, dude, he was about to murder him, and he just pulled back just a little bit. You know,
it's like there were multiple times that I literally watched, and it's the first time it happened.
There were multiple times you were about to jump in the ambulance and go get Jake Paul.
Dude, I was so just disappointed by the fight because, like, the very first time you could see Tyson pull a punch, you're like, oh no. Because in the back of your mind, you kind of knew it that this wasn't going to be for real. Tyson would fucking kill this child, right?
Absolutely. No. He could be 70 and he'd kill him.
Yeah, and as soon as you saw him for the first time, you're just like, oh, so that's how this fight's going. This dude really just took money just to kind of do it.
He needed money.
Back and forth for a couple minutes, and that's it.
He needed money, bro.
I hate it.
Tyson needed money, and that's why it happened.
Yeah, but I feel like he could have still made money. If he went in there and absolutely just totally took Jake Paul's head off of his fucking body,
yeah,
I believe that he could have made a lot of money behind that with, like, the advertisements after that. Nugenics starring Mike Tyson.
Well, yeah, except he'd have to fucking...
Range, like...
except he probably had some kind of clause where he would get sued if he actually hurt him, you know?
Yeah.
So then he'd get fucked. I really did want him to beat the shit out of him, too. Like, I think that's the only reason they made money on that fight, because I sure as fuck didn't pay for it. Fuck you, Jake Paul.
Pretty sure everybody in America wanted to see Jake Paul get his fucking clock cleaned.
Yep.
Speaking of everybody in the fucking country hating you.
All right, boys, today we're going to be talking about Mark Sanchez.
Uh-oh, no, the butt fumble himself.
He just wanted to make sure that he stayed relevant. That's all. The butt fumble's kind of getting old.
It's a little long in
the
tooth.
He's protecting America's grease supply.
He is protecting America's loading zones from
double
parked
trucks. Hey, is
it just
me, or are Candace Owens' eyes just a little too far apart?
She's from Philadelphia.
No, I mean, like, that's not a human being, you know.
got a bit of the Innsmouth look.
Yeah, she's got a little bit of that fish look. Yeah, the Innsmouth.
She's one of the grays.
Yes, definitely. No, she's a red.
But today, boys, we're going to be talking about one Zacharias Basilios Zakharov, or Basil Zakharov.
I got excited because I thought you were going to say. I'll give you one guess as to who I thought you were going to say.
I have no idea.
Zacharias Sitchin.
Oh. We kind of talked about him before.
Yeah.
He's also still alive, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of hard, right? And he's litigious.
Usually He still has a lot more crazy shit to do, so we want to give him, like, allow him to get out his full oeuvre before he expires.
But we may not live to see his oeuvre fucking succeeded, you know? Like, we're going to have.
I mean, when Nibiru comes crashing in.
Israel, well, Steve, that'll Israel's, be good. Israel's going to run out of places to bomb in Gaza. They're going to start targeting leftist cities.
No, you guys didn't hear? There's a ceasefire.
Ceasefire, my ass. They fucking committed so many goddamn war crimes over there. Fucking ridiculous.
I like how Benjamin Netanyahu's plane has to fly in a certain way so it stays out of European airspace on its way to fucking United States.
Yeah, because
like you can see the flight path.
Quarters of the fucking
awesome.
World knows he's a goddamn criminal and they want to fucking arrest him.
Fuck arresting him, dude. Honestly, at this point, just shoot his fucking plane down. Just be done with it. Just be done with it. Just shoot his fucking ass down right out of the air.
Yeah, if you're playing Minecraft, yeah. Anyway, Zacharias Sakharov.
Zacharias was the only son and eldest of four children of Basilius Sakharov, who died in 1878. We don't know when he was born, of Constantinople. He was a Greek notary, commodity dealer, and importer of attar of roses. We don't know much about Zacharias's mother. She was reportedly blind, and it's believed her name was Helena Antonides, who died in 1879.
Okay.
Basil himself was born on October 6, 1849. He was born in the Ottoman town of Menteses in southwest Turkey. His family lived in Russia for over two decades as exiles following the anti-Greek Easter pogroms of 1821.
I don't like southwest Turkey. The spice combination is just not great. Not to my life.
Are you for real? You just fucking off.
I'm just joking.
Oh, I was like, dude, what the fuck? Turkish food is fucking amazing, bro. What are you doing?
Oh my god, no! I said southwest Turkey, like Turkey with like southwestern spice, which at this point is literally just either pepper or ranch or a combination thereof.
Yeah.
I mix the ranch and the pepper together. Whew.
While there, they adopted the surname Zakharov. They returned to the Ottoman Empire in the 1840s, and by 1855 had returned to Constantinople's Greek neighborhood of Tatavla. Zacharias' first job was a tour guide in the Galata. It is thought he became an arsonist with the Constantinople's fire brigades, who were paid to recover or salvage treasures for their wealthy owners.
That's fucking awesome. He's like an early insurance fraud man.
At some point, he was summoned to the court in London due to irregular exports of goods from Constantinople to London. The London Greeks from Constantinople preferred disputes involving members of their community to be settled outside English courts, and he was discharged on the conditions that he paid £100 restitution to the claimant and remained within the court's jurisdiction.
So what happened? He was, like, exporting... He was, once again, committing fraud, like, with exports and imports to London?
Yeah, he was keeping irregular records, like, things weren't adding up. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't sending people the proper amounts, things like that.
They didn't kill him for that?
Well, no, he had to pay £100, and then after that, and he was required to essentially stay within the jurisdiction of the court, but instead he immediately left for Athens, where then 24-year-old Zakharov was befriended by political journalist ATN Skouladas.
Okay, so he's on house arrest, but he says, nah, deuces, dips out to Athens, okay.
Deuces.
Yeah, bye, he just cuts his fucking ankle off and dips out.
man, that's fucking
puts his ankle bracelet on a dog and runs away.
Let me ask you, Ryan, let me ask you a question. If somebody, if you have like a patient, right, and they're in the emergency room and they still require treatment, but they just say deuces and they just fucking jet, what happens?
Goodbye. Have a nice night, bro.
Fucking yeah, I'm you guys call that one a freebie? Yeah, okay. I get it.
Good night, man. Whatever. I mean, we know who you are. We have all your information. Your shit's going to go to billing anyway. Like, the hospital's going to send you a bill for it. You can run out if you want. It doesn't hurt
me. What if I told you my name was Dirk Steele, sovereign citizen, you know?
Good. Congratulations, Mr. Steele. What's going on? What's bringing you tonight? I honestly
soon do. Soon you won't have to, though, right? My life. Isn't that the goal of the Republican Party?
Into the point of my life and the point of my career where if you come into the ER and you're like, hey, my name is fucking Mickey Mouse and I have a problem. All right, Mr. Mouse, come on back. Let's get you taken care of. Like, I just don't care about shit anymore.
Yeah, but you won't have to soon, man. You can just turn them all away.
It's going to get... No, that's never going to happen.
Dumbest shit ever.
What's funny about that, by the way,
one last thing. What's funny about that is that fucking Ronald Reagan put that law into place, so fuck off.
EMTALA.
Yeah, exactly.
So EMTALA is based in good faith, where all it requires is an emergency department has to provide you with a medical screening exam to make sure you're not having an actual medical emergency and stabilization treatment if you are. However, EMTALA has evolved to include, like, an ambulance cannot be refused. So when I'm on the rescue, no hospital, if they have the services, can refuse me to come there without extenuating circumstances. So with EMTALA, I could be sitting in an ambulance, somebody dying in front of me, the hospital can say, no, we're not taking them. And it's like, okay, so where the fuck do you want me to go? We'll go to the next hospital. It prevents somebody getting shot and being next to death, getting like dumped on the hospital's front doorstep. Yeah. And the hospital being like, you don't have insurance, get the fuck out of here. Like, it is based in some sort of empathetic care and forcing the hospitals to do something. But at the end of the day, it is one of those things that has been manipulated by the general public to be like, no, take care of me, I don't give a fuck. That's why you have such insane burnout when you have all services that are offered outside the hospital and the general public refuses to use those services.
I think that like,
we're not using urgent care. I'm coming to the ER for my fucking cough that I've had for 6 months.
Well, that's not, I mean, so, I don't think that's right. Really true in most areas anymore. Most people go to urgent care first, but urgent care doesn't take most things. They usually ship you right out immediately. Like, oh, your heart hurts? Get the fuck out of here. Like, we're not going to help you.
So it depends where you go and the capability of the urgent care, because not all urgent cares are created equal. What I'm talking about is the egregious misuse of the emergency department where people know that they have to be seen. Somebody took a rescue in a couple weeks ago specifically for a pregnancy test. This person called 911 to get brought to the ER by ambulance for a pregnancy test. Like, there's no excuse. That is egregiously irresponsible and a waste of services. And that right there is, like, the thing that when you talk to a healthcare provider, they want that to stop. And we all joke that, like fuck EMTALA, get rid of that shit so we don't even have to see these people. We tell them, like, go fuck off. But the problem occurs when these people come in for these bullshit complaints and you find this incidental thing that will kill them in about a day or two if you don't fix it.
Yeah, like, so fucking it makes it goddamn House MD like, over here.
It makes it very hard to be like, yo, this is bullshit. Because, like, literally, last week, little old lady said, I have a sore throat. And I'm like, oh, whatever, come on back. Her heart's going, like, 210 beats a minute. And I'm like, come on, bro, fuck.
You have a sore throat, that, like, and you appear to have taken some methamphetamine before you came to the ER to help it.
Right. So, like, in any other existence, you know, you look at this person and say, sore throat, go to urgent care. You don't need to be here. Get the fuck out of here. This is the emergency room. This is not an emergency. You got a sore throat. Get out of here. But you send that lady away, she's going to die in her car, right? So it's a double-edged sword that I hate and I love. But, you know,
I feel
it
you.
Is what it is. It's not going away. Like, unfortunately, like Basil of Baker Street over here, it's not going away.
Much like Benghazi, it ain't going away.
Jesus Christ. When's that going to get reopened, you know?
I mean, Charlie Daniels
They hear you. They're going to hear you, and they're going to open up congressional committees tomorrow. Shut the fuck up.
They already fucking know, bro. Nothing. You're like my dad now. Nothing I fucking say affects anything like that, okay? I never knock on wood. I don't fucking throw salt over my fucking shoulder. Fuck that. Say whatever the fuck I want. Things either happen or they don't. But any day now, dude. Benghazi's coming back. Watch.
We gotta bring Hillary Clinton back in for testimony. I don't think it was a fair trial because they found her innocent 16 million times. And no grown man could find her innocent.
the shady import exporter, the shady guy.
He is able to convince Skoulatos of his that he is actually innocent in this London court case. And while he's there, Skoulatos is also friends with a Swedish captain who's about to leave his job as an agent of the arms manufacturer Thorsten Nordenfelt. They're like a major Swedish arms manufacturer.
Yeah, it just sounds. It kind of sounds like a supervillain. Who's responsible for all this? You won't believe it, but the name that came to the top of the list, Thorsten Nordenfelt. Oh no.
But he's a his company eventually merges with Maxim.
The magazine?
Of the gun fame,
Dog, I had every Maxim magazine in high school because every month it would be that little part of a picture and it would like eventually make like a big picture when you line them all up on your shelf.
Hell yeah,
dude,
bro.
Dude, those magazines were such fucking dog shit.
you remember Vita Guerra? Hell yeah.
Oh gosh, he was so hot.
That might have been FHM.
Besides Maxim, too. Oh yeah, that was the other one, FHM. My roommate, after high school, he had FHM. He had so many, it was weird. Like, it was one of those things where it was like, all right, dog, this might be a problem. I want you to talk to somebody.
Look, when my friends come over and they're dudes, I want them to know where they're at and be calm, you know? You can talk about gash here. You can talk about gash and gush.
But I don't want hardcore pornography because that would make people uncomfortable.
Yeah, hardcore is too much. So you can't leave a hustler just laying around. The Playboy, though, is kind of classy, you know?
But instead, you can look at Elizabeth Hurley in lingerie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Four dudes fine. Sitting around reading FHM is not homosexual in at all.
Oh, man. You did not just robot. You fucking full on turned into a series of dudes. Like, it was just like, doo-doo-doo-doo. It's fucking mess over here today. It's got to be on my end. I don't know how, because there's nothing wrong with the internet, but I'm not troubleshooting. I'm off work.
So anyways, Skoulatos gets Zaharoff this job, and he is hired on October 14th, 1877.
Hmm.
So due to the political and military instability within the Balkans, Turkey and Russia provided an excellent opportunity for arms sales, as each state spent to match the intentions of its neighbors, even after their 1878 Treaty of Berlin.
Oh, okay, so this is like, this guy's like a fucking arms dealer then?
Yes, he eventually, he sort of worms his way into being an arms dealer.
Oh god, is this the real life War Dogs guy?
No, he's still alive and occasionally calls into InfoWars.
Wait, the War Dogs guy does?
God of War guy?
No, I'm talking about War Dogs, the one with Jonah Hill, not the one with...
Saw War Dogs. I've seen, like, clips of it. I like that one clip where he's got the gun and, like, the dudes sell him shitty weed or they take his money. And he just pulls his money out of the truck.
Like, all right, he just fucking pops his truck and just fucking fires off a fully automatic MP5. And they're just like, wow! Dude, if you haven't seen it, it's a good movie. You should watch
By the way, my favorite gun clip like that, like righteous gun clip, is definitely from The Gentleman. Where, what's his name? It's the Guy Ritchie movie where, like, he's chasing the dude to get the phone back. He's like, stop fucking around, cunt. And then they're like, how about we cut you? How about you leave that money and run, boy? And then he's like, all right. And then he just pulls out that fucking submachine gun.
And the whole fucking time that like choir version of Shimmy Shimmy Y'all is playing. Ugh. Perfect yeah. fucking scene. One of the greatest scenes ever.
Zaroff did not make arms dealing his only business at first. After Cyprus became a British possession in 1878, he returned to the UK, and by 1883 he was working as a shipping agent in Galway, Ireland, where he recruited local girls for work in American factories.
Also, he's a human trafficker, too.
He also, for a period in the United States, worked as a confidence man and later as a salesman for a St. Louis railcar business.
I love how they just try to church that up by saying that. He works as a confidence man. What is the common term for a confidence man? Oh, he was a con man.
I know. Confidence man is churched up, definitely.
In 1885...
He's a con man, arms dealer. All right.
Yes. In 1885, posing as Prince Zacharias Basilius Zakharov, he married a Philadelphia heiress named Jenny Billings and was pursued to Rotterdam by detectives after his exposure as a bigamist by a British man who recognized him as the same man who had married a British girl in Bristol in 1872.
Ma, what I gotta go. Heiress. I'm married.
What fucking
Listen,
heiress is
I'm
in Philadelphia?
Now.
What is this, the fucking Wawa Listen, heiress? Come on, dog.
I'm married to a Russian man now, Mom. I gotta go. All right.
What? Are you the fucking heiress to Gino's son? Like, what the fuck is
an heiress? Listen, everybody knows you don't go to Gino's when you're actually from Philly, okay? That's not where you go, okay? There's a million other better places to get cheesesteak. Also, cheesesteak wasn't even really technically invented in Philadelphia. It was invented in Delaware. It was in Delco Valley somewhere. You know, the best place to get cheesesteaks in Philadelphia, by the way, is at DeLisandro's, and everybody can fuck off. Everybody knows DeLisandro's best cheesesteak. Fucking Gino's fun to go to once in a while, you know. It's in a shithole kind of neighborhood, fucking row homes everywhere in a shitty, like, Little League field that no one's playing at, and it's covered in police memorabilia, so, you know, it's like eating ammunition barbecue. You
like
feel like you're going to get arrested at any moment.
Isn't Gino's the one that's like built like a triangle or some shit?
Yeah, they're both. They're right across from each other. Gino's and Pat's. They're like literally across the road. Like you could walk to Pat's from Gino's and stand there and eat a cheesesteak outdoors in the winter and stare down your enemies over at Pat's, you know? It's fucking crazy.
And then you just pick up a length of chain and
you
just rumble with
them. You guys didn't grow up. We had cheesesteak wars once or twice a year. I'm just kidding. It never happened. DeLisandro's is definitely a better cheesesteak, by the way.
It was three times a year. Anyways.
Over there on Wendover Street.
Zaharoff would sell munitions to many nations, including Great Britain, Germany, the Russian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, Greece, Spain, Japan, and the United States.
Yeah. You know, with the advent of the recliner, the Ottoman Empire really went on the decline. That's a good joke. You guys suck.
Despite his reputation for corruption, he was instrumental in marketing military equipment, including various weapons such as the Maxim gun, which was one of the first fully automatic machine guns.
Is that like
and
a
the
machine
first
gun
working
that shoots,
submarine?
Like, titty t-shirts or something?
No, the Maxim gun from Red Dead Redemption 2, if I remember correctly, was like he was basically like Jesse Ventura's gun in Predator, but like the very, very grandfather version of that.
Brother, let me tell you something about guns, all right? Let me tell you something, okay? I own several. I know what gun it is. I'm just making Maxim jokes, okay? Leave me alone. Fucking the best British goddamn manufacturer of guns right now, by the way, is fucking Kel-Tec. This is the shitty ass fucking place in Florida. Go look up fucking Kel-Tec KSG. That stupid ass fucking RoboCop looking shotgun, triple barrel rotating shotgun. Ridiculous.
What?
Yeah, Kel-Tec KSG. Go look that shit up.
The United States Army was looking to put in a service that actually shoot 90 degrees around a corner. And I was just like, I don't.
That's
I don't
a
know
real gun.
I think that that's possible. How?
That's a real gun, dude. I'll send it to you.
How the fuck do you shoot 90 yeah degrees around a corner?
My friend who was in the army got to test out the modular gun that they were talking about implementing.
Yeah.
The one where you could it was like fully customizable. You could like turn it into like multiple different types of gun.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, just it's a Krumlov. It's from World War II, I think.
See. How do you shoot 90 degrees around a corner?
Bro, it's a Krumlov. It has a curved barrel. It looks stupid as shit. I'm gonna send you a link to it.
It works because
stupid.
Because it's a smooth connection and it's following the rifling of the barrel.
Yeah. I don't know much about like feedback or any of that kind of stuff on it though.
It's no different than you going through a slide at Wet n' Wild. Zaharoff worked for Vickers, the munitions firm from 1897 to 1927. Hiram Maxim's automatic machine gun was a significant improvement over the then current hand cranked rotary barrel models. Hiram's gun was better than anything that Nordenfeld had sold at the time. Zaharoff believed to have had a hand in events surrounding Maxim's attempts to demonstrate his invention between 1886 and 1888. In the first, Maxim and Nordenfeld's machine guns were to be demonstrated at La Spezia, Italy, under a distinguished audience which included the Duke of Genoa. Maxim's
Fuck.
Representatives did...
The head salami.
Maxim's representatives did not show up. A person unknown had waylaid them with a tour of La Spezia's nocturnal establishments, leaving them unfit to be there in the morning.
So basically somebody got them fucked up and they are way too hungover to show up the next day.
Round two took place at Vienna, where the exhibitors were instructed to modify their weapons to comply with Austrian infantry standard size cartridges.
Hold on, I just want to go back real quick at how badly this article is making this guy, like, try to sound good. Because first it was confidence man, or con man, and now it's nocturnal establishments. So he was in a bar all night long.
Or a brothel.
Or a brothel, either way.
Man.
I mean, you know, regardless, they're really trying to make this guy sound not bad.
After shooting a few hundred rounds, the Maxim gun became erratic before stopping altogether. When Maxim took one weapon apart to see what had happened, he discovered that they had been sabotaged, but it was too late to repair them.
Oh no.
A third demonstration also took place in Vienna, and here the gun worked perfectly, but again, an unknown person went through the gathering of senior officers, convincing them that the workmanship required to produce such a weapon as the Maxim gun could be achieved only by hand, one at a time, and that without the means for mass production, the gun could never be produced in enough quantities for a modern army. With that, Nordenfeld and Zaharoff had won. Maxim, though, who knew he had a good product, successfully saw a merger with Nordenfeld, engaging Zaharoff as their product salesman on a huge commission. Under pressure from Rothschild and Vickers, Thorsten Nordenfeld merged with Maxim's in 1888 to form the Maxim Nordenfeld Guns and Ammunition Company.
That just sounds like a really, like, a really old precursor to, like, Northrop Grumman or some shit.
But 2 years later, Nordenfeld, who was bankrupt, was forced out of the company.
Wait, how is he bankrupt if he owns a fucking company?
Well, he got merged in. He personally is bankrupt.
Oh, okay.
From 1886 to 1889, at the same time that he got the Maxim, Zaharoff got the Maxim machine gun, he managed to appropriate Isaac Peril's submarine. Although some aspects of this are not really known very well.
Okay.
Zaharoff and Nordenfeld tried at this time to develop a submarine for their own business purposes.
What the fuck is their business? A cartel?
Well, they're in the weapons business.
Right. So they're trying to just build a submarine to sell to people.
Yes. One of his most.
Yes.
One of the most notorious sales he's known for was the sale of the Nordenfelt 1, a faulty steam-driven submarine model based on a design by the English inventor and clergyman George Garrett, which U.S. Navy intelligence characterized as capable of dangerous and eccentric movements. Nordenfelt had already demonstrated his vessel at an international gathering of military elite, and while the major powers would not buy it, smaller nations were attracted by the prestige of owning a submarine and thus were willing to purchase it from him just for owning a submarine.
these small countries, we have a population of 400, but look at this submarine that we got. All right, guys.
But with a high fee for the price, Greece would buy one of the first models from Zaharoff.
Swear to God, if this guy was around today, he would absolutely have a payday loan place. Like, yeah. That would be his business nowadays.
Yeah, probably the start of Greece's incredible run of great financial decisions.
Sorry,
Stabby.
Back to the submarine. Yeah. He then went to the Ottoman Empire and persuaded them into buying two submarines because they told them that the one Greek submarine would prove a threat to them.
It's good if you buy two. It's good because if one fail, two submarines.
Listen. I just sold the Greeks a submarine, okay? Now you have to buy two. So that you can out-submarine the submarine. And he's going to go back to Greece and be like, listen, guys, bad news. Turkey just bought two.
Well... He does one better. He doesn't go to Greece. He goes to Russia and gets them to buy two, telling them of this new arm race that's happening with this new insignificant weapon that is a threat to them.
That he himself is selling all these assholes. He is stoking his own arms race. That's fucking awesome.
Oh my God.
None of these submarines would ever see action.
I'm shocked.
All of the submarines, due to their steam-powered propulsion systems, were completely unable to navigate underwater, and failed when undergoing sea trials by their respective navies.
God damn! So now, besides, do all these countries look at this guy and be like, "Hey, give me my fucking money back, bro. This shit doesn't even go in water."
Buy or beware.
Caveat emptor, or whatever the fuck it's called. Have a nice day.
Besides the issues with the propulsion system, they were also very unstable.
Okay.
One of Turkey's.
That's the thing. I don't think they had perfected the ballast tanks in the 1800s. But go ahead.
one of the Ottoman Empire submarines sank during a torpedo firing test where it capsized.
Okay.
The vessel would rear up in a vertical position and then sank by the stern. Wow.
There was so much recoil in this torpedo that we went 180 degrees horizontal or vertical. It just was sank. This is some Looney Tunes-ass shit, but I mean, this is, I guess, how you develop weapons. I mean, like, you gotta... Dumb shit has to happen, man.
Around this time, the Spanish inventor Isaac Peril designed and built the first submarine capable of navigating underwater with a decent level of control and with the ability to launch torpedoes both submerged and on the surface.
Jesus, man. Fucking Discord. Anyway.
This was the first proper submarine as we know them today. Peril's submarine was driven by electric propulsion, and had a periscope, target practice apparatus, compensating compass needle, gyroscope, sliding electric torpedo tube launcher, and servo motor.
God damn. Okay.
Zaharoff
but did it have
found
a
out quickly
servo
about.
Motor?
Oh, you better believe it had a servo.
State of the art.
Got a Fallout.
Could run it for 15 seconds. Crazy.
Zaharoff found out about this, and he had previously already seen plans and files. Of reports by Peril to the Spanish Navy about this. And later, during Peril's visit to London, Zaharoff tried meeting with him unsuccessfully with the help of one of Peril's Spanish, one of his fellow naval officers. Peril refused twice, but after several attempts, he had a meeting with Thorsten Nordenfelt, who offered him a deal to purchase the patent of the stability servo motor. Isaac Peril rejected both offers, but signed his, in doing so, Zaharoff would get to work on an alternative plan to this. The Spanish inventor, as had happened with Maxim, suffered four sabotages during the tests. The first of them, in the presence of the head of the Spanish, leadership. But Peril, more cautious than the North American inventor, proved successful in all of them.
Okay.
I don't even understand
So even though they tried to sabotage him, he was more cautious than Maxim was.
Right.
He succeeded in all of his tests. Mm. So he was able to compensate for them attempting to sabotage him.
Right.
Because he was careful.
Yeah, because he was careful, and he was like more on the lookout for it, possibly because he was like, you know, testing something that he could easily die in.
Yeah.
Gotta say those like pre-flight checklists and all those pre-launch checklists and all those kind of shits exist for a reason.
But despite his success, Zaharoff.
What's the name of that show with all the plane crashes? I can't remember what it's called. The plane crash investigation show. Oh, what the fuck is it called? Air Disasters. Dude, we have seen every fucking season of Air Disasters in this house. It is fascinating. Like, the amount of data they get and the extent that they go to recreate the situations of every air accident. Like, flying is so fucking safe. But you know when it's not safe? When we're not fucking paying the air traffic controllers, you stupid motherfuckers. Anyway, sorry, guys.
But despite his success, Zaharoff, his sabotage attempts would cause a controversy between Peril and the Spanish government, leading to the Spanish government not to approve of the submarine. This would help Spain lose the Spanish-American War, which would happen soon after this.
So they lost because they didn't have submarines?
Well, it would have helped them. Like, they probably would have still lost, but, you know, it was something they could have used.
Yeah.
Zaharoff would travel to Spain several times between 1886 and 1890. His objectives were to get a boycott of the submarine, sell his own weapons to the Spanish army, and then acquire a munitions factory in Spain. He was successful in all three of these, mainly because he began an affair with a Spanish noblewoman named Pilar de Muguero y Breta.
Okay.
Pilar's father was an influential banker named Fermin Muguero, the Count of Muguero. And was a close friend of the king and leader of the Spanish Conservative Party.
So basically, my man is just fucking his way to the top where he needs to be.
So he's sort of entrenching himself by being in this affair with her. He's sort of entrenched himself in with like the Spanish elite. She's also friends with Sigismundo Moret, the leading progressive thinker and leader of the Liberal Party, or the right hand of the leader of the Liberal Party, who's the opposition party to her father's party. Francisco de Bourbon, Duke of Marchena, had given her had through him she had also gained unrestricted access to the royal palaces. So during this trip, Zaharoff was spotted at the shipyard where the Spanish submarine was being built, but the Spanish authorities covered up the matter.
Well, like, he was there just, like, spying on him, like, getting details, taking, like, drawings of the ship and all that other bullshit?
Yeah.
Corporate espionage, that's the word I'm thinking of, right? He's just doing some corporate espionage, trying to make his own ship, right? By stealing their designs.
He was able to acquire the Spanish armament company Escalduna, located in the north of Spain, and renamed it Plasencia de las Armas Corporation Limited. And he, through his sort of relationship he made within the Spanish elite. These people as well would take his side over Perel and Perel developing the submarine. Throughout this whole saga, the Spanish government finally just completely stops funding the development of the submarine.
Eventually just like, no, fuck this. No, we're not giving you another dime. Sorry. We're not giving you another peso. Fuck out of here.
So after his company sells the Spanish government useless weapons that they used during their 1898 war, and also giving Maxim important and sensitive information to his government during this conflict, this is the Spanish-American War, the Sociedad Española de Construcción Navales in Spain, a branch of Vickers, were awarded by the Spanish government the exclusive naval construction rights for the Spanish Navy.
So not his company. Womp womp.
Well, he still sold Maxim some stuff. Remember, by this time, he's become an agent of Vickers.
Oh, okay. So it doesn't matter. He's not on top anyway.
In the aftermath of the scandal, accusations of bribery and manipulation would follow. A Spanish Navy lawyer denounced the Spanish government for two alleged crimes of corruption. The Spanish government acted, the Spanish government would work quickly and harshly against any naval officers who went public about anything that had gone on in the saga. The central chief of staff and the head of the Armada juridic service were fired, and hundreds of officers were imprisoned and lost their jobs.
Oh, goddamn.
Zaharoff's power and influence in Spain would last until his death in 1936, which would be the year the Spanish Civil War began. A 1934 United States Senate Nye Committee memorandum shows that Zaharoff was paid considerable amounts of money, that he had paid considerable sums for transactions made between foreign companies and the Spanish government, where he got paid a 5-7% commission for the price of American submarines sold to Spain throughout all these years.
God damn. That's a lot of money.
Although very little could be proven, Zaharoff was viewed as a master of bribery and corruption, but the few incidents that did not become public, such as the large bribes received by Japanese Admiral Fuji in the 1914 Siemens scandal, indicate that a lot more was going on behind the scenes. In 1890, when the Maxim-Nordenfeldt Association broke up, Zaharoff chose to go with Maxim, and using his commissions, Zaharoff bought shares of Maxim's company until he was able to tell Maxim that he was no longer an employee but an equal shareholder.
Oh, man. Is he doing like a hostile takeover? Like,
well, in 1897, the Maxim Company became large enough to do a buyout of, or I should say, the Maxim Company had become economically desirable enough that the Vickers Company offered to buy them out, which they did.
Okay.
This would result in large settlements in both cash and shares for Maxim and Zaharoff. And from then until 1911, while Maxim's business began to decline, Zaharoff's business began to rise, and he expanded his portfolio of Vickers shares. After Maxim retired, Zaharoff was appointed to Vickers' board of directors. In the early 1900s, this was a large time of military buildup in the years before World War I.
Just fall asleep and like wake up like that comedian does.
He just had a little funky nodded off there for a second.
Oh, there was like a solid 10 seconds of silence. You know, that's a radio sin. We probably just didn't hear you, or maybe I didn't hear you. I don't know.
Well, I was seeing if you were still there.
It's breaking up so much that I can't tell what you're saying half the time, so I'm just kind of waiting until I can.
And you'll just add in some bon mots.
Yeah. Have you heard Steven's latest bon mot?
In the lead up to World War I, Germany and the United Kingdom sought to improve their navies, Vickers, with Zaharoff on its board of directors, were willing and able to sell arms to both sides.
Of course they were.
After Japan defeated Russia in the Russo-Japanese War, the Russian Navy also needed new equipment, but Russia was forced to rely on local and domestic industry due to protectionism that had risen up. In response to this, Zaharoff built a Russian arms production complex in Russia at Tsaritsyn as a subsidiary of Vickers.
So basically, like, hey, listen, we'll build a factory here. You buy all our shit.
The opening of the archives of Tsarist Russia after World War I led to some insights into how this came to be. One 1907 letter, which was written from Paul von Gontard factory, a serially controlled Vickers company in Germany, to a Vickers associate in Paris, recommended that press releases be sent out to French press suggesting that the French improve their military to meet the threat posed by German rearmament. These French newspaper articles were recorded by the Reichstag and instigated a vote to increase military spending, all of which worked to the advantage of Zaharoff.
Not the Reichstag.
In the years immediately before World War I, Zaharoff his fortunes would grow in other business to support his arms business. He would purchase Les Unions Parisiennes des Banques, which is a heavy industry bank. So he was better able to control financing. He gained control of Excelsior, a popular French daily newspaper, so he could guarantee favorable editorials for the arms industry. In order to build up his own image, he founded a retirement home for ex-French Navy sailors, while a chair in aerodynamics at the University of Paris led to him being given more honors. In April of 1914, Australian newspapers published reports from London dated April 25th that Zaharoff had donated £20,000 in order to enable France to be worthily represented at the forthcoming Olympic Games in Berlin in 1916.
It's a pretty heavy bet.
The 1916 Olympics obviously didn't happen due to World War I, but his donation represented a substantial contribution.
Did he wait? Did he wait to donate like until he saw World War I about to go down? Just so he wouldn't
hold it.
Well, I don't think they sent back the check. I don't think they're like, well, you know, sorry, we can't have it.
You have the French government. Black Panther Barty. That's the voice I heard. I hope you have fun in your Black Panther party.
The French government announced it would donate 6,000 pounds to its Olympic team and would distribute 12,000 of Zaharoff's donation among its Olympic teams, with the remaining 8,000 to the Olympics itself. Hmm. On July 31st, 1914, the same day that the French anti-militarist Jean Jaurès was assassinated, Raymond Poincaré signed a decree appointing Zaharoff a commander of the Legion of Honor.
This guy just keeps failing upwards. Like, he doesn't really Poincaré just happens to be in the right place at the right time.
Poincaré was like the leader, at the time.
Yeah, he gave him the Legion. Yeah, he gave him the Legion of Honor, which is like the highest like award you can get in France.
Yeah. Actually, no. I think the highest award.
He's a con man and an arms dealer.
No. I think the highest award you can get in France is actually being accepted by the French public, but not born there, right? Usually, they just tell you to join the Legion.
So the war would be very profitable, obviously, for Vickers and Zaharoff.
I'll make a lot of money on this war.
During the war, Vickers would produce 4 ships of the line, 3 cruisers, 53 submarines, 3 auxiliary vessels, 62 light vessels, 2,328 cannons, 8 million tons of steel ordnance, 90,000 mines, 22,000 torpedoes, 5,500 airplanes, and 100,000 machine guns.
Imagine...
Jesus Christ.
Imagine how much, like... beneficial shit you could make with all those fucking supplies.
Well, you need the machine gun to hunt the super animals. You know?
Oh, dude, it's so ridiculous.
By 1915, Zaharoff had close ties with both David Lloyd George and Aristide Briand. It is reported that on one visit with Briand, Zaharoff... surreptitiously left an envelope on Aristide Briand's desk. The envelope contained 1,000,000 francs for war widows.
That's a lot just, of like, you know, a lot of francs.
Like a mob.
Just, yeah, like, you know, mob? He just put it in a suit jacket.
Yeah,
left it in a newspaper. One of Zaharoff's tasks, though, during the war was to ensure that Greece joined the war on the Allied side, hoping to reinforce the Eastern Front. This seemed somewhat impossible for the same reason that a lot of these relationships were awkward, is because King Constantine, the king of Greece, was the brother-in-law of the Kaiser.
Kaiser Schoese?
Zaharoff said... Yeah, it's the same. setting up a press agency in Greece to publish British propaganda, contacted by Wellington House, Zaharoff led within a few months. This would lead in a few months to King Constantine's overthrow by Prime Minister Eleftherios Venizelos and Greek entry into the war as an ally of the British Empire.
And here we go. Here we go into the Dan Carlin most confusing shit. What is it? The apocalypse on the edge of apocalypse, World War One history thing, where it's just names and places, and it's just like, oh god, I'm not going to know any of these people, I'm not going to remember, and I have to act like I know.
Oh, dude,
he told me 5 minutes ago.
Have you read The Guns of August?
No. It's like, let me stop you and have I read?
Well, get the audiobook. The audiobook's really good. It's very long, but it's like the widely considered the best history of World War One, and it's what's called Barbara Tuchman. But I don't remember most of it. Like, there's so many fucking names, so many people, so many events, and it's just like...
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a lot.
You really need some repetition on it. It's not something you're going to remember, like, once.
In 1917 and 18, on the behest of David Lloyd George, Zaharoff initiated a series of secret peace negotiations with the Ottoman Empire.
Is that the English guy?
Yeah, he's the prime minister.
He's a prime minister.
Which we can get on July 18th, 1917. The British government hoped that Zaharoff could convince the three pashas to abandon the Central Powers and make a separate peace with the Allies.
Pasha, that's a good fucking, good board game.
Oi! We'll make peace with the Yankston.
By the end of World War I, the Times estimated that Zaharoff had laid out 50 million pounds for the Allied cause.
Golly! This dude is just rolling in money.
Fitty mil?
In the years after the war, Zaharoff involved himself in the affairs of the lesser nations of Europe, which the Big Four, who had come out on top of the Allies, would ignore. He ensured that Greece received a proper share from the spoils from the badly weakened Turkey. And in 1920, he donated half a billion gold francs to the Greek state for the Greek cause. Zaharoff convinced Venizelos to attack, but after a very successful initial attack, the Greek army was eventually driven back.
Sorry, this ain't the Greek army of was it Sparta? No, in Athens. No, it's not that same Greek army.
This is also sort of like what makes Ataturk is that he kicks all these guys out of Turkey. In the elections that followed, Constantine's loyalists managed to force Venizelos to flee the country, but Zaharoff stayed around to persuade the same king that he had to attack Turkey again. But with Kemal now in charge of Turkey, Mustafa Kemal, later Ataturk, this venture failed.
Okay.
His war adventures were not well received by the press in Paris and London. He was also
not really
involved
a big fan
in two...
of this fucking guy.
He was also involved in two large financial ventures in October of 1920. Becoming involved in the incorporation of a company that was a predecessor to the modern-day company BP, British Petroleum.
I knew it. BP is always doing some scandalous shit.
He
you
firmly
guys
believed
when they
that
had
there
that
was
a little oil spill. And
that, what? Which one? It was so small, I don't even remember. But which one are you talking about?
Nah, it was massive.
bro. BP.
Yeah.
BP never had any oil spills, man. Just chill. Relax, man.
Oh, that's true.
Never been on
that's
BP.
True, yeah.
It's been on the faulty construction of the BP construction or the BP equipment. BP cannot be held accountable for what the contracted repair people did.
Yeah.
We did not spill oil.
You literally, sound like an extra from you're doing your recitation of the landman scene you're applying for.
I heard the C4 was woke, and that's why it failed.
Yeah, it was C5.
And listen, when the oil spill happened, who was the largest donor to cleanup? BP. So yeah, please get off my nuts.
Okay.
You know. Okay. I hear. I heard a lot of those ocean animals. They were them, so that's why they had to. You know.
Ugh. Fucking those bluegill.
You know my. You know what? You know what my pronouns are? Die in oil.
Jesus Christ.
My pronouns are dawn and soap, okay? Because if it's good enough for them little baby ducks, it's good enough for me, goddammit.
It's good enough for ducks.
He was, Zaharoff was friends with Prince Louis II of Monaco, which would lead him to purchase the debt-ridden...
Prince Louis?
Société des Bains de Mer,
Also known as the Monaco Raceway. The grandfather of F1 in Monaco.
Yes, which would be the world-famous Monte Carlo Casino. It was the principal source of revenue for the principality. He would bring the casino back to profitability. And at the same time, Zaharoff would convince French leader Clemenceau to ensure that the Treaty of Versailles included protection of Monaco's rights as established in 1641. Lewis had noted that that sort of Monaco's independence had been eroding over the subsequent centuries, and this would ensure that Monaco would remain an independent principality, and also that gambling would remain legal there. Zaharoff would spend the rest of his life in Monaco, running the casino, and would die on November 27th, 1936.
Wow. So he never went to jail, not one time.
Nope.
Huh.
So, like,
how many people did he kill?
Shit arms dealer, con man, right?
Yeah.
Who basically facilitated the incorporation of BP, and probably, if you dug more, he probably had something to do with ThyssenKrupp, the elevator company, but it was also like huge into arms in World War I as well.
Well, like, it's hard to believe
this guy didn't have his fingers in that too as well.
Well, when he died, he was one of the richest men in the world.
Oh my god. So where'd all his money go?
I'm not entirely sure. I'm sure he had a lot of like bastard children.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, I don't think he was married, right?
Fighting over it to this day.
Well, no, he was married to a lot of people. In 1924, he married his mistress, Maria del Pilar Antonio Angela.
It would be better to ask who he wasn't married to.
Fermita Simona de Maguero y Breta.
Sounds like a fucking polycule. Okay, so they're all fighting over his money. Heard.
Which is, no, that was just one person. That was his. That was the woman he was carrying on the affair with.
Freaking Skeefooza.
But she died.
I don't ever want to hear another person make fun of another person's name ever. It took Steve 32 business seconds to get that one name out. Don't ever make fun of anybody else's name ever again.
Yeah.
Not us.
But he, because remember, one of the things that he got in trouble for was that he committed bigamy.
Right.
Right. All right, well, he's dead now. He's dead, Jim.
Yeah,
bigamy. That's where you like marry someone that is when you're already married, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was. Up. As I said, I think last week, it's fucked up, especially during that time period where we lived in such a hyper paternalistic society that women had like no agency. So if you fucking marry one and they, like, put all their hopes on this marriage working out and now you've left them in the wind, you should be fucking shot.
And then, like, you have to agree to a divorce, too. Like, if they want a divorce, like, the husband has to agree as well. It's like,
yeah, their no-fault divorce didn't end until 1968. Like, something like that. Actually, I think it was in the 70s.
You could get no-fault divorce in Reno. Because that was, for a long time, Reno was like one of the only places in the United States you get no-fault divorces.
How does that work? It's a state thing.
You would live in Reno for 6 months and you could call for divorce there. Which
sounds
even though
completely
your marriage
fucking reasonable. Like, this is not the life hack it sounds like at the time.
You get married in any state, but if you got divorced in another state, it had to be accepted like your marriage due to essentially the Constitution. And that what you would do is you would spend 6 months in Reno and you would get divorced there after being there for 6 months. And there was actually a bridge there where people would throw their like wedding rings in this one river. It was like sort of like a ceremony.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Yeah, in 1909, it became the divorce capital of the world, and it was only 6 months after Nevada had, after 6 months of established residency, you could You could get a divorce.
So basically, like, I would just fly out there myself and get a divorce. I wouldn't have to, like, drag my like, wife with me and be like, we both have to live here for 6 months.
You would have to be there for 6 months.
But, like, just one party, right?
Yeah, just one of you.
That's fucked up, though, man. Nah, that's pretty bad.
Dude, if you have no other option...
Dude,
like,
there are
hey,
hundreds of thousands of people getting married every year. Like... Not all of them can afford
Reno
to just
place for the divorce
nope to Reno for 6 months. You know what I mean?
No, because this is well before Vegas was established.
I'm saying not... Oh. The reason I'm saying it's shitty, like, I understand there's a workaround, right? Is that not... Most women could not afford to just nope out to Reno. Like, they were not going to nope out to Reno for six months.
The residency period got lowered to 3 months in 1927...
3 months is more reasonable in Reno in 1927 because you could fucking pay for your hotel room for a week on two double bubble wrappers and and a shtickle of fluoride, you know,
like and that. You sweep the floor for them
6th Street.
Yeah,
and in hey, 19
this is the
and
wrapper
19...
from my cheese that I just ate for lunch, sir. Come right in.
We got a high roller. Let him in.
Yeah.
In 1931, they reduced it to 6 weeks.
That's even better.
That's more reasonable, you know, because I could see myself just going for 6 weeks, you know.
I want to fly out to Reno and get on the plane next to some, like, just, like, random dude and be like, yeah, I'm going to divorce my bitch wife.
Well, they...
Oh, my God.
And the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed in 1942 in Williams v. North Carolina that states had to recognize these divorces. And the reason why they reduced the wait from down to 6 weeks in 1931, because it's also when the state legalized gambling, like wide open gambling in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew it was a tourism thing. So it was like the only place in the world even. In some cases, where you could easily get a divorce like that.
Yeah.
Because it used to be shorthand, because in the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the one main character, his love interest or whatever, his friend makes a comment and says, you know, it's like, she knows she just got back from Reno, and that was shorthand for she had gotten divorced, because they couldn't say divorce due to the Hays Code.
Yeah, well, they were trying to say she's a whore, but they couldn't say that, you know.
if you want to tap that, buddy, go right ahead.
Slut just got back from Reno. She's well and fucked. All right,
she got the big D in Reno, if you know what I mean.
Delisandro's cheesesteaks,
exactly.
And with that,
and then
good night.
After that,
got just like rush off the set. All right, well, that's it, right? He's dead.
Yep, he's dead.
So this topic about cheesesteaks. Because now I want a cheesesteak and it's 10:30 at night and I can't get one until at least fucking Saturday. All right. Good evening.
Good night. Good luck.
Bye. Gino's is the best cheesesteak I can fucking see. Says bye.